rencontre, qui est professeur à l'Université de Santa Cruz, a passé sa thèse au LAM avec Jean-Paul Kneb, essentiellement. Et aussi, j'ai découvert aujourd'hui avec Olivier Lefebvre comme supervisor. Après, Alexis a eu la Chamberlain Fellowship pour partir en postdoc à Berkeley. Ensuite, a fait un postdoc au Kavli Institute à Tokyo, pas beaucoup de mois après le désastre de Fukushima, je m'en souviens. Et après, il a rejoint en 2016 la faculté de l'University of California, Santa Cruz. Et depuis, elle a obtenu pas mal de prix et distinctions, parmi lesquels un ERC Grant, le Sloan Fellowship, le Department of Energy Career Award et un autre encore dont je m'en souviens plus. Et donc, ben maintenant, je pense qu'on peut passer à l'anglais et Alexis, entre-temps,
Super,
permettre.
merci Carlos. Je vais passer à l'anglais bientôt, mais d'abord, je voulais juste vous dire que mon co-directeur de thèse, c'était Olivier Lefebvre, et je voulais dédier ce doc à lui parce que c'était vraiment un très bon directeur de thèse et il m'a donné beaucoup de bons conseils pendant ma thèse et il va nous manquer tous. Et en plus, c'était un très bon vivant. Je me rappelle, il a apporté beaucoup d'énergie et de joie de vie au LAM. Donc, voilà. Et en plus, il aimait la formation des galaxies. Donc, c'est pour ça que j'ai choisi aujourd'hui de parler de la formation des galaxies. Et avec ça, je passe en anglais parce que je ne peux plus faire des talks en français. C'est plus possible. Donc, English coming now. So,
Okay.
I'm going to talk about very, very massive galaxies, most massive galaxies in the universe. So, this is work we've been working on a number of years. And I wanted to begin by introducing some vocabulary, especially if they're grad students. And so we know that the universe has these very large dark matter halos, and they can extend from several hundreds of kiloparsecs out to several megaparsecs. And galaxies live within these dark matter halos, and we distinguish central galaxies that live at the center of the dark matter halo versus satellite galaxies that orbit around in this potential. And central galaxies and satellite galaxies have different physics of galaxy formation. I'm going to focus more on central galaxies, and in particular, there's a concept I want to introduce because it's going to be relevant later, which is central galaxies have in-situ stars, and those are stars that are formed by gas cooling from the dark matter halo into the central galaxy and forming in place. That's why we call them in situ. But central galaxies can also grow via ex situ growth, and that is when they cannibalize a small galaxy and it accretes onto this bigger galaxy and brings in stars that were formed elsewhere, hence the word ex situ. So that will become relevant later. I'm going to talk a lot about the connection between the dark matter halo, the in-situ stars and the ex-situ stars. But we need to measure the dark matter halo, which is non-trivial. I'm going to use a technique called galaxy-galaxy lensing. And this is a form of weak lensing. And but unlike cosmic shear, it focuses around particular galaxies. So you take a set of galaxies and you take a set of annuli, and then you measure the weak lensing signal as a function of R. And in particular, the kind of figures that I'm going to mainly show you are delta sigma. This is a measure of the projected surface mass density of dark matter as a function of r, where r is a distance along the x-axis. And the key thing to know about these figures is that they tell you directly about halo mass. And so the amplitude of this figure correlates with halo mass. And if you have a lower amplitude, you have a smaller projected surface density, you have a lower halo mass. And if you have a higher amplitude, you can have a higher halo mass. And I'm going to show you a set of figures where we see these curves go up and down. And so you can just think low halo mass, high halo mass, and you'll be able to understand the figure. All right. So when I did my thesis in Marseille, the primary focus was understanding the relationship between halo mass and galaxy mass. And that's called the stellar to halo mass relation. And I'm showing this here. This is halo mass on the x-axis, and galaxy mass on the y-axis. And this is at the very, very massive end. We start at 10 to the 11. We see this nice trend between halos and galaxies. What we've been working on a lot recently is adding in galaxy size. So trying to ask, for very massive galaxies, does the size depend on the halo mass? And you could also call this the stellar to halo to size relation. And so that's what the sort of the focus of this talk is about. A lot of this work was done by Song Huang. And all of this comes out of the Hypo Supremechem survey, which I got involved in when I was in Japan. And Hypo Supremechem is a very beautiful instrument on a super telescope on Mauna Kea. It's a wide field of view and it's designed to do gravitational lensing. Because it's on Subaru, it goes wide and deep at the same time. And so we have these beautiful images of these massive galaxies with very deep imaging, eye of 26. And we have a very wide field so we can capture the very massive and very rare objects. And what we studied with Song is the outskirts of these galaxies. Now, these are real galaxies from HSC. This is a 100 kpc distance, and this is a 10 kpc distance. And what you will see is that even just by eye, you can see that the HSC data can measure the light up to about 100 kpc. And so this was pretty novel at the time because no other data set could really do this. Sloan had to use stacking. No other survey had the depth and breadth to do this. So measuring the light directly is what a lot of this science is based on. So this is taking very, very massive galaxies. This is 10 to the 11.5, 7, and almost 10 to the 12. And looking at their light profiles. So this is the distance here. So you can see we go up to 100 kpc. And then mu star is the surface density of stars. And you can see all these underlying gray lines. The very light gray lines are all of the measurements. And I want to underscore that these are not noisy. Like, this is not noise out here. These are genuine galaxies that are compact or extended. As you can see from this slide, like we can see compact galaxies and we see extended galaxies. And then these are the average light profiles for these bins. So in this particular paper, we highlighted the diversity of massive galaxies. We said, hey, massive galaxies are not all self-similar. Some of them are really compact and some of them are really extended. We want to understand the physics of why that happens. And to summarize these light profiles, we're going to introduce two quantities just to make it simple to make a plot. M100 is the mass within 100 kpc. It's close to the total mass of the galaxy. And then M10 is the mass within the inner part of the galaxy. And I'm going to show you figures of M10 versus M100. This is a cloud of points because galaxies are not self-similar. If they were, they would lie on a line. But instead, you have galaxies that are more compact that will live over here, and galaxies that are more extended that will live over here. So we're going to look at how the dark matter halo changes across this plane. So this is now the same plane where this is basically M100, it's that total mass, versus the inner mass of the galaxy on the y-axis. And these little boxes are where we're going to make our weak lensing measurement, and we're going to step across this plane. And this insert shows you the weak lensing signal. So remember I said higher amplitude, higher halo mass, lower amplitude, lower halo mass. So you don't have to go and model this with an NFW or any fancy model. You can just look at this and say higher, lower, because the lensing signal to noise is so beautiful. Now, lensing has come a long way. When I did my thesis at LAM, I would have been happy to have a 3-sigma detection for this whole plane. That would have been exciting. But we now have data sets that have way exceeded the capabilities we had back then. And we can now really divide things into smaller bins and study more intricate correlations across these properties. And that's, this kind of stuff with Euclid is going to be really amazing. Like, we really have the ability to probe the dark matter. So let's look at these bins. So we're going to look at halo mass. This is the weak cleansing signal. And yeah, this has error bars on it. So this is how good our lensing data has become. Okay, so we're going to step up. Oh, what happened there? Oh, I pushed the wrong way. Okay. It's pretty obvious. You don't need a model to see that the halo masses are changing across this plane. And so that was pretty cool. And the way the halo masses are changing is indicated by the underlying red color. So this is a hot, this is a 10 to the 14 halo. It's a high halo mass. And this is a 10 to the 13 halo. And what you see is this strong gradient across this plane with massive halos living over here and low mass halos living over here. And this is really interesting because, you know, we think of very massive galaxies halos, but there's actually a wide range. This ranges from a few 10 to the 13, a few 10 to the 12, to a few 10 to the 14. So two orders of magnitude in halo mass. But by adding in size, we get a better discriminator of which halos, which galaxies live in which halos, with the more extended galaxies living in the more massive dark matter halos. So this was one of the things that we found, is that larger galaxies live in larger dark matter halos. And you could also say that this is the halo mass dependence of the mass size relation. And I'll just pause to say, this, if you think about it, this may not seem too surprising, because when we think of galaxy clusters, we think of the galaxies that live at the center, the BCGs, having very extended, sometimes called CD envelope shapes. But this actually hadn't been seen before. When this was studied with Sloan, no one found a halo mass dependence to the mass size relation because the data were not good enough. With deep enough high quality data, we are able to see this dependence. So I want to try to give you a sense of why this might occur. And it comes back to the in-situ ex-situ stars that we talked about earlier. So the inner part of massive galaxies, which is encoded in this M10, the mass within 10 kpc, is formed at high redshift, around redshift of 2, when the halos are forming very fast. There's a lot of violent disk instabilities, a lot of merges. It forms the core of the galaxy. But the core of the galaxy at redshift 2 may have little to do with the halo mass today. And instead, massive galaxies quench and form a lot of their stars below redshift 1 from ex-situ star formation. So ex-situ star formation is merging, and it puffs up the outer envelopes and it deposits stars on the outskirts. So galaxies that have had a lot of ex-situ star ex-situ growth have puffier envelopes, which is why we think that stars that live over here that are more extended are tracing the ex-situ growth and are tracing the late time formation of the halo and correlates well with halo mass. And I'm going to come back, and we're going to restudy this again in a few minutes. So this was the first thing we found, was this correlation. But this physics picture of in-situ, ex-situ led us to think, well, if this is true, like here we studied the total galaxy mass, maybe we should just study the outer mass, because outer mass better correlates with ex-situ. Let's just think about the outer mass. And so this is a paper that we're finishing up that you should see on the archive fairly soon. And the title encapsulates the results that I'm going to show you now, which is that the outer stellar mass of galaxies, so this envelope, is a very good tracer of halo mass. In fact, it's good enough that it's comparable to the best optical cluster finders, such as RedMapper or other ones. And in addition, what I want to explain is that it probably has reduced projection effects. And if you study clusters, you'll know that projection effects have become at the forefront and were a big issue for the DS cluster cosmology paper. And so everyone's scrambling to try to understand what they do. And this method may just bypass that whole problem. So what we did in this work was we used the test that we call the top-end test. And what it is very simple. You can take any kind of objects and you select them at fixed number density. So you select the top 50 for your different categories, and then you measure the weak lensing signal. And if you select according to something that correlates really well with halo mass, you will have a high lensing amplitude. And if you select according to something that doesn't correlate with halo mass, you will have a very low lensing amplitude. And so this is what this diagram illustrates here. This is halo mass, and this is something, your observable, color, mass, metallicity, size, whatever. And there's some correlation here. And this one is the best tracer, and this is a really bad tracer. We selected the fixed number density, and you can see that the green one has a very broad halo mass distribution, and the mean halo mass is down here, whereas the blue one has a really tight correlation and a high halo mass, hence the higher lensing amplitude. So we did this test for a number of things, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to step you through the main results. So result number one is if you take a pipeline measured quantity, for example, if you go to the Sloan catalog and you say, what is the luminosity of a massive galaxy? It will give you a C model magnitude. That's a pipeline fit to massive galaxies, assuming a de Vaucouleurs and a exponential profile. But the models that are used do not describe massive galaxies very well. They're very poor models for massive galaxies, and that's a whole other conversation we can go into. But as a result, there's a large mismeasurement of the luminosity, and that introduces a scatter in the halo mass tracer. So this is our best tracer up here, which I'll talk about later. Well, it's one of our good tracers. And then down here in blue is the lensing amplitude when you select by C model. You don't have to be a lensing person to see that the amplitude is way offset. We were really surprised. If you look here, this is like a 50% reduction in the signal. And that's because it is a very poor tracer of halo mass. And so the takeaway message here is that how you measure luminosity matters. And if you want to get at the dark matter distribution, if you want to understand clusters, if you want to understand where the massive halos are, you should not use poorly measured luminosities. Second result is what I hinted at earlier, is that the outer envelope mass has an excellent performance. And I'm showing you here the circles, the dark circles are the outer mass. So we're now looking at the mass between 50 and 100 kpc. So we've taken out the inner part. And I'm comparing that with the amplitude that you get if you use things selected by RedMapper. So RedMapper is one of the state-of-the-art optical cluster finders. It finds clusters by finding richness, looks for red galaxies, and makes groups of red galaxies and calls that a cluster. And it's really surprising, hence my title, New Surprises, that the outer mass alone, in terms of the lensing, does as well as these really sophisticated models that have been developed for the last decade. But it does. The lensing amplitude is the same. And in fact, it may even perform better at low halo mass. So if we go to a few 10 to the 13, you can see that the solid data points are above the triangles, meaning that the outer mass is a better tracer than richness. And the reason this might happen is something that we call historical richness. If you count the red galaxies today, that's just a measure of the satellites today. But remember that a lot in the past, a lot of these satellites accreted onto the central. That's the ex-situ mass that we're probing. So the ex-situ mass is a measure of the historical richness of the halo. So in some sense, it is a richness measure. It's just not the richness at the present time. So that's result number two. And on the same theme, we can quantify this with a quantity that is the scatter. So this is the scatter in the halo mass when you select according to different observables. And this is the number density that we're using. And if you're familiar with richness, this is the red mapper richness. So the first, and so to get a good halo mass tracer, you want this to be low. You want a low scatter. So the first thing is C model. Well, we saw that was really bad, just like way above here. That's not good. But then what I want to point out is we have the state-of-the-art richness things, red mapper and Chimera down here. And then our outer mass in blue, that is comparable. And maybe even better at the low mass end. Now, you might quibble and say, oh, it looks better down here. But this is actually an artifact that I'll explain later that I think is due to projection effects. And I think actually our outer mass is better here for a number of reasons. So result number three is related to projection effects. So when you select clusters by selecting a bunch of red galaxies, usually this is done without a lot of spectroscopy, just based on the photometry, you may be actually often selecting things that are projected along the line of sight. So you have a cluster here and a cluster here, and you can't tell the difference. That's very difficult to model when you're doing your cosmology, especially because we don't understand how red galaxies form. So this has created a number of really big issues. If you know the recent DS paper, their cosmological contours were shifted to like omega m of 0.2 or something. And they attribute this in part perhaps to projection effects. So projection effects show up in the shape of the lensing signal. If you have a projected system, it affects the total surface density as measured by lensing. And without going into explanations of why this is, I'm just going to give you the punchline. You can see here that red mapper has this bump. You can see these four data points around here that don't fit in with the gray line. Our data points follow the gray line really well, and the gray line is a theoretical model built on simulations where there's no projection effects. So we think that the shape of the lensing signal is also indicating that these richness-based cluster finders have these projection effects, which are becoming an issue with our current signal to noise. It's going to be way worse with Euclid. The lensing is going to get really, really tiny error bars, and all of this will start to matter a great deal. So result number four is very interesting for people who care about galaxy formation. And I'll also just mention this in the context, there's been a lot of literature about sigma 1, the inner mass of the galaxy is a great tracer, the inner mass is really good at all this stuff. Lensing tells us the opposite. Lensing tells us that the inner mass is a very poor tracer of halo mass. And again, this is not model dependent. I can show you the lensing amplitudes and you can just say, this is really high and this is really low. So this is again the scatter, and this is now the inner mass of the galaxy from 10 kpc to 75 kpc. And there's a very clear trend. Like if you take the 10 kpc mass up here, it has a very poor correlation with halo mass. And these axes are different. So this goes down to 0.3. So this is the total mass of the galaxy in green. And you can see that the outer mass performs even better. So actually, if you want to get a good tracer of halo mass, you remove the central region, because we think the central region has a lot of stochasticity, and it was formed at high redshift, and probably traces more the conditions of the halo at redshift of 2. That's our guess as to why this happens. So I mentioned this already, but why? Again, this is just a guess. This is what we'd be working on. But we think that the inner halo mass correlates with early formation, And ex-situ mass correlates with late-time growth, so present-day halo mass. So the takeaway messages from this work are going to be that with deep enough imaging, we may be able to find clusters just by looking at the extended envelopes of galaxies. And this may give us a better tool to find central galaxies directly with a fairly decent scatter in this tracer to halo mass relation and with reduced projection effects. So there's a lot of implications for optical based cluster finding. There's obviously a lot more work to do, so we're working on it, but there's a ton of stuff to do. And there's a lot of work to be done in terms of understanding the covariance between the galaxy properties and the properties as traced by X-rays or TSC, and all of the ways in which these different observables interconnect. Okay, so I'm going to spend two more slides and then we will wrap up on a completely different topic, just because I want to tell you about it in 2 minutes. And this takes us from very massive galaxies to tiny, tiny galaxies. So this is related to dwarf galaxies. And so I'm going to talk about galaxies in the mass range 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9. So this is the upper range of the dwarf galaxy sample. And we've started a new program. It's called the Marion Survey. And this is my key collaborators on the Marion Survey. And I'll just spend 2 seconds to tell you about our namesake, Marion, why we called this survey. Marion was a 17th century entomologist. She studied insects. And she was one of the first female, well, recognized scientists. And the two reasons we liked her as our namesake. One is that she studied insects. So she studied these really tiny things, and dwarfs are really tiny galaxies. And secondly, one of the key things she did is she had very strong observational skills. In 1717, most scientists studied the world by reading Aristotle and Socrates and Plato. And like, well, Aristotle said things were this way, so this is what we're gonna believe. Instead, she actually collected insects and she put them in boxes and she looked at them and saw what happened. And because of this incredible power of observations, which we use today, she discovered that caterpillars turn into butterflies. And previously people thought that butterflies were just born from pieces of earth. Like all of a sudden, a butterfly would come out of the earth. And she said, no, actually caterpillars turn into butterflies. So that was a cool discovery based on the power of observation. So Marion is a survey that started in January, and we've built 2 filters that are installed on the Blanco telescope, and they probe the O3 and H-alpha emission lines at about redshift 0.08. So not 0.8, 0.08. And it's designed specifically to find the emission lines of dwarf galaxies. And the survey is designed to do gravitational lensing around dwarf galaxies. But there'll be lots of ancillary science. We expect to find about 100,000 dwarf galaxies in this mass range. And this should be enough to do gravitational lensing and study the dark matter halo masses of these dwarf galaxies. And furthermore, this is also a learning experience for Rubin, because adding custom-made filters to Rubin, I think, is going to be a really interesting way of extracting more science from the Rubin telescope. This is one of our filters. It's huge. This is a 1-degree filter built by Asahi in Japan. I won't tell you how much it costs. It's exorbitant. And this is some of our first data. This is HFC imaging. This is Marion. This is a 10 to the 9 galaxy. So this is a dwarf. And you can see this emission line. This is the kind of emission line that we're going to use to collect our sample. This is 10 to the 8.5, and this is 10 to the 8. So at 10 to the 8, these dwarfs are becoming tiny little smudges. And so I will finish here. And so I talked about very massive galaxies and very briefly about tiny galaxies. And I hope you are all enjoying the beach in Marseille and that you have some wonderful summer holiday plans. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you very much, Alexis. Really, really nice conclusion also, and not talking about this slide.
Yeah, on a tous besoin de vacances cette année. Plus que d'habitude, après le COVID.
Is there any comment or question? I have a curiosity. Yeah, please, please, Eric.
I'm just looking at the beach.
I know, Rosé, Rosé.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you very much for this talk. It was really very interesting, and the survey and the name of the survey is really also very nice. So, thanks for this. I'm not sure that I understood all the consequences of the results that you are presenting here, because there is a lot of things to understand. But I was trying to figure out, according to your experience, what is the best let's say, indicator of richness for a cluster that you will use if you had the choice. So this is my first question. And I have also another question, and it's more a comment than a question, is that when you move towards higher redshift clusters, groups, etc., and galaxies, I suspect that things are going to be much more difficult because, of course, there are obvious evidences of evolution, and also the filters we use to gather all these outskirts to 100 kiloparsec scales. It's going to be very difficult, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you cannot use the CD galaxy to an indicator of the center of the cluster. So if you could comment on how you see this richness determination, if you wanted to try to trace the dark matter heroes, for instance.
What's the best? So in terms of what is the best richness, I don't know. I had a graduate student who was studying this, but unfortunately he left, so that work is paused. But my hunch was that, first of all, I think you could build on this to build something even better. Like maybe you combine the outskirts with some richness and you improve both of them. And I suspect there are some measurable gains to be made. Secondly, I think there's probably a trade-off. So if you use the outer light, you probably have almost no projection effects. You're finding the central galaxies directly. But the more you include richness out to large radii, the more you're subject to projection effects. But maybe there's some intermediate scale where you can use outer light plus richness, maybe out to a few hundred kpc. I don't know. And maybe there's a compromise. I'm going to tolerate a bit of projection effect, but I'll improve my scatter. So I think it depends on what you want to do and whether you care about projection effects. So I think that's a really cool thing to explore, is that trade-off. I also think something that I didn't mention, I suspect that our light is going to pick out older halos. So you might have a slight bias toward older halos that maybe you could compensate by adding a little bit of richness in to get a more age-independent tracer. And then the second question was about higher redshifts, and the answer is I don't know.
This is the question, is that you have shown results from red mapper, for instance.
Yes.
And of course, it assumes that there is a very well-defined red sequence in this cluster, so it's not actually true in high redshift clusters and protoclusters.
Absolutely. Yeah. In HSC, we study this out to redshift 0.5.
Okay.
So I know how it holds to 0.5. I don't know what happens above 0.5.
Okay, so essentially your studies are limited to the more or less local universe in this respect.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happens above. I think it would be really cool to study. I didn't have the time yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, and I would just briefly mention, this is kind of an interesting point you might be interested in. We do have very massive galaxies that, according to Lenzing, live in pretty massive halos that have almost no richness. So there are things that Redmapper just completely misses. And my hunch is that those are probably very old halos. Mm-hmm. All the galaxies have already merged.
And there is a lot of scatter eventually on low richness side.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, we noticed that already in a paper by a student here can you confirm the richness of the clusters with X-rays, for instance?
Right.
You clean a lot the Redmapper catalog.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The and that was the regime where DS ran into problems in their paper. It was their low richness bin, and then they did this tricky thing after unblinding, where they said, "Oh, the cosmology looks wrong. We'll remove that last bin."
Yeah. Yes, yeah. That happened when they unblinded.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that regime is really hard.
Olivier, please.
Yes, so maybe I missed one point. In your sample, do you have only red galaxy or you have any kind of galaxy?
That's a really great question. It's mainly red galaxies. At this very high mass end, it's mainly just red galaxies anyway. But an ongoing project is to try to understand very massive spiral or bluish kind of galaxies, because I think that's a super interesting question. And I don't have an answer for you beyond saying I think there's something really cool to be discovered there, but I don't know what it is. So I don't know whether spirals, very, very massive spirals, trace halos in the same way, or do they have a different formation history? I don't know.
Yeah. I guess it could be different.
It could be different. And sort of the key thing I want to know is, I could imagine very massive spirals being transitory. Like it's an early type galaxy that has some burst of star formation or a merger and temporarily turns into a blue, more disky thing, but then goes back to an early type. In which case, maybe then it's just stochastic and they're the same as their big ones. Or maybe there's actually a genuine halo formation history difference, like their halos are a lot younger, in which case we would maybe see that in the lensing and they would trace different kinds of halos. And so I don't know what at all what they do. And it's hard to study in simulations because there's so few of them. But simulations are getting bigger, hydrosims.
Thank you. So the urgency of having good simulations and not to refuse simulation. Alexey, I'm curious, would you benefit of an instrument able to do the spectroscopy of the outer part of the galaxies, allowing to estimate the mass of the outer part of the galaxy only from spectroscopy?
Yeah, that's a really great question. These galaxies have fairly shallow color gradients. And one thing an undergrad looked into, which is not published yet, I really want her to finish the paper, but she looked at the age and metallicity of the in-situ and the ex-situ component using simulations. So she took TNG and she said, here's the in-situ and here's the ex-situ. And the idea was that we were hoping maybe we can decorrelate the two. Maybe they're like, maybe the metallicity has some feature and we can try to decorrelate the ex-situ component. But it turns out the in-situ and the ex-situ are basically two parallels. When you add them together, you just get a parallel that kind of goes like that. And so that looks pretty not promising. And so I don't know whether, I'm not sure age or metallicity measurements would get you a whole lot more information. But having said that, these galaxies have been really surprising. So... Yeah, the universe may not look like TNG, so I don't know.
How would you estimate the mass of the outer part of the galaxy from a spectrum?
I think the spectrum. So when we estimate the mass, we have the luminosity and the 5-band HSC photometry. So we fit in SED. If you had the spectroscopy, you would improve your SED. And you would improve your measurement of the star formation history. And so I think it would help. But again, I'm not sure. I don't know how helpful it would be.
Yeah, I remember something, maybe Olivier, Eric are figuring out what I'm thinking about, the possibility opened by the Batman-like instrument. This is an instrument based on DMD, the digital micro device that you can can program and tune toward a spectral arm or an imaging band of an instrument. And so you can program to you image a galaxy. You recognize the region, the outer part, and then you tilt the micromirrors corresponding only to the outer part. From the light coming only from the outer part, you can do the spectrum.
Oh, interesting. Cool.
Now, the problem is the signal to noise, I suppose, because the outer part is less luminous, but, well.
Yeah, it's less luminous, but you can also do redshift. Like, you could do this at redshift 0.1. Mm-hmm. We have surveys that are big enough now that you can find lots of these galaxies at 0.1. Mm-hmm. So maybe that helps. And then I think what that science really starts getting into is the IMF. Because there are suggestions that the IMF varies in these galaxies, and that may be related to the in-situ ex-situ thing. So maybe the in-situ part has a different IMF than the outer part, and there are spectral signatures that are IMF indicators. And the thing that I've always wanted to do, but actually we had a MUSE program that got canceled because of COVID. To connect the spectroscopy and the gradients with the weak lensing to try to disentangle halo variations versus IMF gradients. I think IMF and inner dark matter slope is what you start to get at when you have the spectroscopy. And maybe our MUSE program will be come back. I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever get that time back again.
Thank you. Any other, Eric, please.
Yes, so I was wondering also, so in your analysis, you do not select specifically central or satellite galaxies, do you?
No.
Okay, so you could have some fraction, especially on the low mass side of satellite galaxies. And yes. I was wondering, because it's a bit counterintuitive to what you find that the outskirt is a good tracer of the halo mass. For satellite, at least, we expect to have some dark matter stripping happening in this case.
Yeah.
Might not.
Yeah. So in the mass range that I've talked about, above 11.4, we've estimated the satellite fraction, and it varies from 8-10% down to like 2%.
All right, it's small.
It's very low. Having said that, there are 5% of satellites, and it does impact the lensing signal. So something that's in the paper, but I didn't talk about, is there is a small feature due to the satellites, mm-hmm. but it's a much smaller feature than the projection effects. Now, when I said we can use this method to just go and find centrals, I didn't say in parentheses, you still have to remove those 5% of satellites. So there is a bit of extra work to be done there. And I was hoping to do that work with the DESI survey, because we have all the spectroscopy, and try to understand, okay, how well can we remove those 5% of satellites? And is that a problem? Is that a limiting factor? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the other side, it's also a nice science topic to learn, to look at the satellites specifically.
Yeah, absolutely. And then your second point about the tidal stripping, I think this is one reason the outer mass works really well, because only central galaxies experience this. Do I have to take a leave?
5 minutes tonight.
Okay. Kevin's giving me the 5 minute warning that I got to take my daughter to summer camp. So, only central galaxies experience this merging. So they build out the extended envelopes. So satellites shouldn't really have extended envelopes, except that they could have been a central in a previous halo and then merged on. And I think those are the 5% are the things that have recently merged and still have some kind of extended envelope from when they were a central before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting topic to look at.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be done. And DESI's going to be great for this, Eric, for spectroscopy, for cluster stuff.
Yeah.
Is Olive Lam in DESI? I don't remember.
Sorry?
Is Olive Lam in DESI?
No.
No, okay. No. All right. I have been called to do...
We should stop here, right, Alexei? you're
yeah, I
got 4 minutes to close. Thank you again for
thanks so much. Maybe see you in December if things